My name is Charlotte Wolf. I work for ArcelorMittal, and I would like to thank you for inviting us, or me, to present here today. Human rights is a really important topic for us at ArcelorMittal, and I hope I will be able to share some interesting insights into our experience of implementing human rights principles in the business. The topic for this panel is about how business should operate in conflict zones. I'm not sure if I can tell you exactly how to do it, because it's complex, but I want to share some lessons learned. But just briefly, I wanted to give you a brief introduction to my company, as you might not be so aware of what we do. So ArcelorMittal is the world's biggest steel producer. It's also one of the world's biggest iron ore and coal miners. We have a major presence also in the USA. So you might be aware of Bethlehem Steel, or Republic Steel. They're now part of ArcelorMittal Group. We're based in Luxembourg. And that's all I want to say about ArcelorMittal, just so you know who you're talking to. We have 264,000 employees, direct employees in the world, but obviously we have many more contractors. Going forward, our business is very much focusing on growing in developing countries, especially mining. So it's already taking us to the Arctic in Canada, Liberia, Kuzbass in Siberia, and so on, Kazakhstan, also the US, and also increasing our steel production in India and Brazil. So human rights is absolutely critical for the success of this strategy of growing in these countries where we know that human rights abuses do prevail. So we started to formalize our approach on human rights about 2 years ago. And I just need to remind you that the company is quite young. So we are a sum of merger after merger after merger, but the company has been in existence since 2007. So after about 2 years thereafter, we then start looking at human rights, which indeed was maybe not quite early enough, but I would say that when we do something, we do it with force. And we took about 1 year to develop our policy, because rather than having somebody drafting it for it and us adopting it, we wanted the business to understand what it was getting into. So some of you I know took part in our consultation roundtables, but we went around the world for about 1 year to understand what does it really mean for a business. And I think we've got quite a good pragmatic policy as a response. So what have we done since then? Well, between February and September this year, we trained already 46,700 employees on human rights and what it means in a business context. But we will not stop before everybody in the business has been trained and understands what it means to respect human rights within ArcelorMittal. We also have detailed training for management teams in high-risk countries, and also we are currently carrying out local human rights impact assessments. These impact assessments are actually not so hard to carry out at all. I don't think so. But the results are really hard. The action plans that follow from the assessments are quite difficult to implement. I think that's where the sort of time lag comes in. And it's quite difficult because usually it always leads down to the fact that there's weak governance locally and there's weak capacity to respect human rights at state level. So I would be happy to take any questions on how we've developed our policy and during the panel discussion. And also, if you want to give me your business cards, I'm happy to send you our latest human rights update. But I wanted to talk a little bit about operating conflict zones. So what does conflict mean? Is it war, civil conflict, labor conflict, or even organized crime? When our company actually operates in areas where this prevails today, all of these areas that I just mentioned. But for the purposes of today, I wanted to just mention one example, which is not a conflict zone, but it's a country that is recovering from a recent history of terrible war. So today I will talk about Liberia, that's located in West Africa. I actually returned from Liberia this morning. And coincidentally, I think the president is receiving, the Liberian president is receiving her Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, tomorrow, I think, if not today or tomorrow. So the UN Global Compact group on conflict-affected regions sort of has a few sort of items where it says that actually what causes conflict. And I'm just going to mention a couple. For instance, human rights violations, lack of equal economic and social opportunity, chronic poverty, and poor management of revenues, including from natural resources. So operating a business in a post-war environment offers, of course, many challenges. But I do believe that business can actually support some of these issues. And I think many reports, I think I saw one outside as well, have now shown evidence that private sector activity bring more people out of poverty than development aid. And therefore, I would also make a statement that business can promote social cohesion in a given region. But you have to be aware of what you're doing. And if you ignore the fact that you can actually create peace and social cohesion, it's not going to happen as a byproduct. You have to be absolutely determined that it's there and what you're trying to reach out for. So I'm just going to put this into context. Back to Liberia. After 14 years of civil war, Liberia finally achieved peace in 2004. 1 year later, ArcelorMittal, the company I work for, announced a $1 billion mining investment into the country. At this point in time, the country was shattered, to say the least. There was no infrastructure, and with that I mean no electricity, hospitals, schools, or roads. I think this is probably one of the most devastating wars ever, because everything was destroyed. There was not even a road to travel on. Many Liberian children and youth had not been attending school or during the whole conflict, which makes Liberia one of the few countries in the world where the older generation is better educated than the younger one. So in this context, business is not enough. Business as usual is not enough if you enter this kind of a country. And you really have to see yourself as a development partner to that country. So one of the first tasks we had when we moved to ArcelorMittal moved to Liberia was to rehabilitate the almost 250-kilometer long railway between the mine site in the north and the port in the south of the country. This is usually done by a big, enormous machine. I have no idea what these machines cost, but maybe several hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. But the problem we have is we couldn't even insure this machine to Liberia. But how do you even take it off the port when you don't even, your ship can't even dock because the port's destroyed? So what we decided to do was to actually do it manually, rehabilitate the whole railway manually. But how do you do that? You can't buy 1,000 crowbars for railway maintenance anymore. They don't exist because we don't build railways this way anymore. But we decided to do this. And consequently, we had about 50 parties of 80 workmen each, all along the railway, beavering away, lifting wooden ties rather than concrete ties to develop this railway. At the peak of the time of this activity, we employed about 5,000 Liberians. Now, all workers had access to mobile clinics, clean water and food, and were subject to daily occupational health and safety trainings and local clinics. It's believed that every salaried person in Liberia benefits 20 to 25 people. So the decision to do this work using manual labor rather than machinery must have made a major impact on society as a whole, and it was a great way to kickstart the economy. But this is by no means a lone example. We also work through our procurement in the country. So so far we spent $800 million on this project, but we spent way more in Liberia than we ever thought possible. So we're taking on us to actually train our local suppliers on human rights, anti-corruption, and all kinds of other issues, and we formed the Corporate Responsibility Forum for Liberia together with the German Development Fund. And we're actually trying to train all the local entrepreneurs on how do you do business in the modern world. And we think we've helped many of them to actually get contracts with other multinationals who followed our footsteps. So I can't put a figure on how many people we helped into a better quality of life in Liberia. And I'm quite certain that our presence in the country has made it clear to other foreign investors that the country is now open for business. And since our initial investment pledge, foreign investments into Liberia total $22 billion. So we actually helped all those investments come into country. I also have other examples from Bosnia-Herzegovina, etc., but you know, we can talk about that over coffee. I just wanted to show you a couple of pictures just to bring this home. So we talked about very high-level issues, so I just want to show you a few pictures of what I mean when you try to basically improve the economy of a country that's quite devastated by war. So I will quickly whisk through this, and hopefully you can see this in the light that we have. So, I don't know if you can see it from the back, but this is bush, you would have thought. It's actually the railway we had to rehabilitate that had basically completely been destroyed during the war, partly by scrappers, but also tropical forest. So this is the old track that was still there beneath all the bush. And this is now the present condition of the railway, which is the first line of transport in the country for 20 years. Here we got village carts that used to be on the tracks. You can see men operating these bamboo carts. This is their livelihood. They take people to market. And basically, loads of markets grew up all along the railway, so where these little carts were used, where there were still tracks left. This is obviously a big hazard. We can't have this on the railway where we have heavy goods traffic on this railway. So what was very important for us was to work with the local community around the railways, basically moving their markets aside, away from the railway, and also make sure that we had alternative livelihoods for these people who ran the cart services. And here you can see, if you're close, you can see there's a bright red wheelbarrow in the middle, and basically the cart handlers got wheelbarrows, and we had a big ceremony, and actually now they get the same money as they did before, if not more, using these wheelbarrows. But actually it was a great saving grace for them, because as we improved the road along the railway, taxis emerged in the country, which means that this old cart handling was actually no longer a viable business. So it would have basically died away anyway. So this is what the road was when I was the first time in Liberia 4 years ago. You could basically not really move around the country unless you had a UN helicopter. This is what the road looks like now. And with roads comes traffic. And I would basically say that every car, local car, is unworthy, unroadworthy, and very dangerous. So what we decided to do is that we trained every single taxi driver together with the local police on road safety in all the three counties where we're present. They got their bumper stickers. It's an issue of honor and pride, and more people want these bumper stickers. So the president asks whether we could run this program in the rest of the country. Well, we're not really in the business of road safety in the whole country, but this concept certainly can be used by other concessionaires. We also train everybody on health and safety every single day. And I have to give you a little anecdote. As I said, I came back from Liberia this morning. I was wondering why people who run our vegetable patches and cut grass to keep snakes away and stuff like that, why are they wearing hard hats and fluorescent vests? I mean, I don't know, radishes might, I don't know, bump on your head or something, but it was not to dilute the issue of health and safety. So everybody, it doesn't matter what job you do, you wear a hard hat and a fluorescent vest. But what's even more important is that an issue of pride. To have paid work, employment, is an issue of honor. So they proudly walk around with the hard hats and the fluorescent vests. This didn't work at all, my real estate pictures. So I go next. So this is my final picture. This is what the railway looks today. This picture is from the 23rd of September this year. It was the first shipment of iron ore out of Liberia for 20 years. It's the first time for 20 years the country will get royalties into the exchequer It was a very moving moment to see the old miners, they're all about 60, 65 years old now, crying on the port side, seeing that their country was literally back on track. And I know I'm slightly over time, I just want to say one final thing. So has our human rights policy that we adopted changed anything in the business? And I'm going to bring it back to Liberia in a second. And I would say the answer is most definitely, because it actually requires us to think about issues more broadly. So if you take water from a steel plant perspective, we look at water from a production perspective. The policy demands us to think about water also from a human perspective. It also gives us a clearer code of behavior, and also basically, it gives us the mandate to discuss humanity inside the business, which wasn't there before. And finally, I would say that don't underestimate the appetite for human rights in your business. I probably trained about, 5,000-6,000 people on human rights over the last year. There's been so much debate, passion, anger in the room, because human rights means so much to people. And I can't believe we didn't do it any earlier. Just as Bennett said, we are a bit late on this, but it's been a brilliant journey and it's going to make the business only better. Thank you.